superior to it, yet in such a way, mind you, that it is the single individual who, after having been subordinate to the universal as the particular, now through the universal becomes the single individual who, as the particular, is superior to it. Faith is this paradox, that the single individual as the particular stands in an absolute relation to the absolute. This standpoint cannot be mediated, for all mediation occurs precisely by virtue of the universal. It is and forever remains a paradox, inaccessible to thought. And yet faith is this paradox, or else, these are the consequences I would ask the reader to bear in mind at every point, even though it would be too prolix for me to write them down everywhere, or else faith has never existed just because it has always existed, or else Abraham is lost. That for the single individual this paradox can easily be confused with a temptation is certainly true, but one ought not for that reason to conceal it. That many people may be wholly constituted in such a way that it repulses them is certainly true, but one ought not for that reason to make faith into something different in order to be able to have it as well, but ought rather to admit that one does not have it, while those who have faith ought to be prepared to post some criteria by which to distinguish the paradox from a temptation. Now the story of Abraham contains such a teleological suspension of the ethical. There has been no lack of keen heads and thorough scholars who have found analogies to it. Their wisdom amounts to the pretty proposition that, basically, everything is the same. If one will look a little closer, I doubt very much whether one will find a single analogy in the whole world, except a later one that proves nothing if it is certain that Abraham represents faith, and that it is properly expressed in him, whose life is not only the most paradoxical that can be thought, but so paradoxical that it cannot be thought at all. Abraham acts by virtue of the absurd, for the absurd is precisely that he, as the single individual, is higher than the universal. This paradox cannot be mediated, for as soon as Abraham sets out to do that, he must admit that he was in a state of temptation, and if that is so, he never gets to the point of sacrificing Isaac, or if he has sacrificed Isaac, he must then repentantly return to the universal. He gets Isaac back again by virtue of the absurd. Abraham is therefore at no moment a tragic hero, but something entirely different, either a murderer or a believer. Abraham lacks the middle term that saves the tragic hero. That is why I can understand a tragic hero but cannot understand Abraham, even though in a certain demented sense I admire him more than all others. Abraham's relation to Isaac, ethically speaking, is quite simply this, that the father must love the son more than himself. Yet the ethical has within its own scope several gradations. We shall see whether this story contains any sort of higher expression for the ethical that can ethically explain his behaviour, ethically justify him in suspending the ethical duty to the son, yet without therefore moving beyond the teleology of the ethical. When an undertaking of concern to a whole people is impeded, when such an enterprise is brought to a standstill by heaven's disfavour, when the angry deity sends a dead calm that mocks all efforts, when the soothsayer carries out his sad task and proclaims that the deity demands a young girl as sacrifice, then the father heroically must bring this sacrifice. He must conceal his pain magnanimously, even though he could wish he was the lowly man who dares to weep, not the king who must act regally. And however solitarily the pain penetrates his breast, he has only three confidants among the people, and soon the whole population will be privy to his pain, but also to his deed, that for the welfare of all he would sacrifice her, his daughter, the lovely young maiden. O bosom, O fair cheeks, flaxen hair, verse 687. And the daughter will move him with her tears, and the father will avert his face, but the hero will raise the knife. Then, when the news about that reaches the ancestral home, the beautiful maidens of Greece will blush with enthusiasm, and if the daughter was to be a bride, the betrothed would not be angry but proud of participating in the father's deed, because the maiden belonged to him more tenderly than to the father. When that brave judge who saved Israel in the hour of need binds God and himself in one breath by the same vow, heroically he will transform the young girl's jubilation, the beloved daughter's joy to sorrow, and all Israel will grieve with her over her maidenly youth. But every free-born man will understand, every stout-hearted woman will admire Jephthah, and every maiden in Israel will wish to act as his daughter did. For what is the use of Jephthah having conquered by means of his vow, if he did not keep it? Would not the victory be taken away again from the people? When a son forgets his duty, when the state entrusts the father with the sword of judgment, when the laws demand punishment from the father's hand, the father heroically must forget that the guilty one is his son. He magnanimously must conceal his pain, but there will not be a single person among the people, not even the son, who will fail to admire the father. And whenever the laws of Rome are interpreted, it must be remembered that many interpreted them more learnedly, but none more gloriously than Brutus. However, if Agamemnon, while a favourable wind was carrying the fleet at full sail to its destination, had dispatched that messenger who fetched Iphigenia to be sacrificed, if Jephthah, without being bound by any vow that determined the fate of the people, had said to his daughter, "Grieve now for 2 months over your brief youth, and then I will sacrifice you." If Brutus had had a righteous son, and yet had summoned the lictors to execute him, who then would have understood them? If, upon being asked why they did it, these three men had answered, "It is a trial in which we are being tested," would anyone then have understood them better? When, at the decisive moment, Agamemnon, Jephthah, and Brutus heroically have overcome the pain, heroically have lost the beloved, and merely must complete the deed externally, there never will be a noble soul in the world without tears of sympathy for their pain, and tears of admiration for their deed. However, if at the decisive moment these three men were to add to the heroic courage with which they bore their pain the little phrase, "But it will not happen," who then would understand them? If, as an explanation, they added, "We believe it by virtue of the absurd," who then would understand them better? For who would not easily understand that it was absurd, but who would understand that one could then believe it? The difference between the tragic hero and Abraham is obvious. The tragic hero still remains within the ethical. He lets an expression of the ethical have its telos in a higher expression of the ethical. He reduces the ethical relation between father and son, or daughter and father, to a sentiment that has its dialectic in its relation to the idea of the ethical life. Here, then, there can be no question of a teleological suspension of the ethical itself. The case is different with Abraham. By his act, he transcended the whole of the ethical and had a higher telos outside in relation to which he suspended it. For I would certainly like to know how Abraham's act can be brought into relation to the universal, whether any connection can be discovered between what Abraham did and the universal, other than that Abraham overstepped it. It is not to save a people, not to uphold the idea of the state, not to appease angry gods that Abraham does it. If there could be any question of the deity being angry, then he still was angry only at Abraham, and Abraham's whole deed stands in no relation to the universal. It is a purely private undertaking. While the tragic hero is therefore great by his ethical virtue, Abraham is great by a purely personal virtue. There is no higher expression for the ethical in Abraham's life than this, that the father must love the son. There can be no question at all of the ethical in the sense of the ethical life. Insofar as the universal was present, it was still latent in Isaac, hidden, so to speak, in Isaac's loins, and must then cry out with Isaac's mouth, "Do not do it, you are destroying everything." Why does Abraham do it then? For God's sake, and what is altogether identical with this, for his own sake. He does it for God's sake, because God demands this proof of his faith. He does it for his own sake, so that he can prove it. Hence the unity is quite rightly expressed in the word always used to denote this relation. It is a trial, a temptation. A temptation? But what does that mean? That which ordinarily tempts a person, to be sure, is whatever would keep him from doing his duty. But here the temptation is the ethical itself, which would keep him from doing God's will. But what, then, is the duty? Well, the duty is precisely the expression for God's will. Here the necessity of a new category for understanding Abraham becomes apparent. Such a relationship to the divine is unknown in paganism. The tragic hero does not enter into any private relation to the deity, but the ethical is the divine, and therefore the paradox in it can be mediated in the universal. Abraham cannot be mediated, which can also be expressed by saying he cannot speak. As soon as I speak, I express the universal, and if I do not do that, then no one can understand me. As soon as Abraham wants to express himself in the universal, he must say that his situation is a temptation, for he has no higher expression for the universal that ranks above the universal he oversteps. While Abraham therefore arouses my admiration, he appalls me as well. Whoever denies himself and sacrifices himself for duty gives up the finite in order to grasp the infinite and is secure enough. The tragic hero gives up the certain for the even more certain, and the eye of the beholder rests confidently upon him. But the one who gives up the universal in order to grasp something still higher that is not the universal, what does he do? Is it possible that this can be anything other than a temptation? And if it is possible, but the single individual then made a mistake, what salvation is there for him? He suffers all the pain of the tragic hero. He destroys his joy in the world. He renounces everything, and perhaps at the same moment blocks himself from the sublime joy which was so precious to him that he would buy it at any price. The observer cannot understand him at all, nor confidently rest his eyes upon him. Perhaps what the believer intends cannot be done at all, since it is indeed inconceivable. Or if it could be done, but the individual has misunderstood the deity, what salvation would there be for him? The tragic hero needs and demands tears. And where was the envious eye so arid that it could not weep with Agamemnon? But where was the one whose soul was so confused that he had the audacity to weep over Abraham? The tragic hero accomplishes his deed at a definite moment of time, but in the course of time he does something no less significant. He visits someone whose soul is enveloped by sorrow, whose breast cannot get air because of its anguished sighs, whose thoughts, pregnant with tears, weigh heavy upon him. The tragic hero appears before him, breaks the spell of sorrow, loosens the corset, and elicits the tears as the sufferer forgets his sufferings in the tragic hero's. One cannot weep over Abraham. One approaches him with a religious awe, as Israel approached Mount Sinai. What if, then, the lonely man who climbs Mount Moriah, which at its peak towers sky high over the plains of Aulis, what if he is not a sleepwalker who goes safely across the precipice, while the one standing at the foot of the mountain looking on trembles with anxiety and, out of respect and fright, does not once dare call to him? What if he becomes flustered? What if he has made a mistake? Thanks! Again, thanks be to a man who offers the one who has been overcome by life's sorrows and left behind naked, offers him the expression, the leaf of the word, with which he can hide his wretchedness. Thanks be to you, great Shakespeare, You who can say everything, everything, everything exactly as it is. And yet, why did you never give expression to this torment? Did you perhaps reserve it for yourself, like the beloved whose name one cannot bear the world even to mention? For a poet buys this power of the word to tell everybody else's dark secrets at the cost of a little secret he cannot divulge, and a poet is not an apostle. He casts out devils only by the power of the devil. But if the ethical is indeed teleologically suspended in this manner, how then does the single individual in whom it is suspended exist? He exists as the particular in contrast to the universal. Does he then sin? For this is the form of sin viewed ideally, so that even though the child does not sin because it is not conscious of its existence as such, its existence, viewed ideally, is nevertheless still sin, and the ethical exacts its claim upon the child at every moment. If one denies that this form can be repeated in such a way that it is not sin, then judgment has fallen upon Abraham. How, then, did Abraham exist? He believed. That is the paradox by which he remains at the apex, and which he cannot make clear to anyone else. For the paradox is that he, as the single individual, places himself in an absolute relation to the absolute. Is he justified? His justification is again the paradox, for if he is justified, it is not by virtue of being something universal, but by virtue of being the particular. How does the single individual assure himself that he is justified? It is easy enough to level all existence to the idea of the state or the idea of a society. If one does that, then it is also easy enough to mediate, for then one does not come at all to the paradox that the single individual as the particular is higher than the universal, which I can also express appropriately in a proposition of Pythagoras, to the effect that the odd number is more perfect than the even number. Insofar as one occasionally hears a reply tending toward the paradox in our age, it generally goes like this. One judges it according to the outcome. A hero who has become an offence or stumbling block to his age in the awareness that he is a paradox that cannot make itself intelligible, cries out confidently to his contemporaries, "The outcome will indeed show that I was justified." This cry is rarely heard in our age, for just as it does not produce heroes, which is its defect, so also it has the advantage of producing few caricatures. When someone in our age hears these words, "It will be judged according to the outcome," then it is clear right away with whom one has the honour of speaking. Those who talk this way are a numerous lot, whom I shall designate by the common name of associate professors. Secured in life, they live in their thoughts. They have a permanent position and secure prospects in a well-organised state. They have centuries, or indeed even millennia, between themselves and the earthquakes of existence. They do not fear that such things can be repeated, for what indeed would the police and newspapers say? Their task in life is to judge the great men, and to judge them according to the outcome. Such conduct toward the great betrays a curious mixture of arrogance and wretchedness. Arrogance, because they feel called to pass judgment. Wretchedness, because they do not feel their lives are even remotely related to those of the great. Surely anyone with only a smattering of nobility of nature has not become a completely cold and clammy worm, and when he approaches the great, it can never escape his mind that since the creation of the world, it has been customary for the result to come last, and that if one is in truth to learn anything from the great, it is precisely the beginning to which one must be attentive. If the one who is to act wants to judge himself by the outcome, then he will never begin. Even though the outcome may delight the whole world, it cannot help the hero, for he only came to know the outcome when the whole thing was over, and he did not become a hero by that, but by the fact that he began. Moreover, the outcome, insofar as it is finitude's answer to the infinite question, is in its dialectic altogether heterogeneous to the hero's existence. Or would it be possible to prove that Abraham was justified in relating himself as the single individual to the universal by the fact that he got Isaac by a miracle? If Abraham actually had sacrificed Isaac, would he therefore have been less justified? But people are curious about the outcome, just as they are about the outcome of a book. They do not want to know anything about the anxiety, the distress, the paradox. They flirt aesthetically with the outcome. It comes just as unexpectedly, but also just as easily as a prize in the lottery. And when they have heard the outcome, they are edified. And yet, no robber of churches who toils in irons is so base a criminal as the one who plunders the holy in this way. And not even Judas, who sold his Lord for 30 pieces of silver, is more contemptible than the one who peddles greatness in this way. It goes against the grain for me to speak inhumanly about the great, to let it darken into an indefinite form at a great distance, to let it be great without bringing out the human element in it, without which it ceases to be great. For it is not what happens to me that makes me great, but what I do. And there is surely no one who thinks that a man became great because he won the grand prize in the lottery. Even if a person were born in humble circumstances, I would still insist that he not be so inhuman towards himself as to be unable to imagine the king's castle except at a distance, vaguely dreaming about its greatness and wanting thereby to elevate and destroy it at the same time because he elevated it in a base manner. I insist that he be human enough to step forward there with confidence and dignity as well. He must not be so inhuman as rudely to offend everyone by storming into the king's hall from off the street, thereby losing more than the king. On the contrary, he should find pleasure in observing every dictate of propriety with glad and confident enthusiasm, which is precisely what will make him frank and open. This is only a simile, for that difference is only a very imperfect expression for the distance of spirit. I insist of every person that he must not think so inhumanly of himself that he dare not enter those palaces where not only the memory of the chosen lives, but where they themselves reside. He must not rudely push himself forward and impute his kinship with them. He must be happy every time he bows before them. But he must be frank and confident, and always be something more than a nurse's aid, for if he does not want to be more than that, he will never be admitted there. And what will help him is precisely the anxiety and distress in which the great are tried, for otherwise, if he has a scrap of backbone, they will merely arouse his righteous envy. And what can be great only at a distance? What people want to make into something great by the help of empty and hollow phrases, that they themselves destroy. Who was ever so great in the world as that favoured woman, the Mother of God, the Virgin Mary? And yet, how does one speak of her? That she was favoured among women does not make her great. And if it did not so oddly happen that those who hear can think just as inhumanly as those who speak, then every young girl must indeed ask, why was I not also favoured? And if I had nothing else to say, I would not at all dismiss such a question as stupid, for with respect to a favour, abstractly viewed, every person is equally entitled. One leaves out the distress, the anxiety, the paradox. My thought is as pure as anyone's, and the thought of one who can think this way will surely become pure, and if that is not so, he has something frightful to expect as well. For anyone who has once evoked these images cannot get rid of them again, and if he sins against them, then they take terrible revenge through a quiet wrath more frightful than the clamour of 10 ferocious critics. Certainly Mary bore the child, miraculously, but it still went with her after the manner of women, and this time is one of anxiety, distress, and paradox. The angel was surely a ministering spirit, but he was not an obliging spirit who went to the other young maidens in Israel and said, "Do not despise Mary, something extraordinary is happening to her." The angel appeared only to Mary, and no one could understand her. After all, what woman was more offended against than Mary? And is it not also true here that the one whom God blesses, he curses in the same breath? This is the Spirit's understanding of Mary, and she is by no means, which shocks me to say, but is even more shocking that people have thoughtlessly and frivolously understood her in this way, she is by no means a lady who parades in her finery and plays with a divine child. When she then nevertheless says, "Behold, I am the handmaid of the Lord," she is therefore great. And I think it should not be difficult to explain why she became the mother of God. She needs no worldly admiration, just as little as Abraham needs tears. For she was no heroine, and he was no hero. But they both by no means became greater than these by being exempt from distress and torment and the paradox, but became that through them. It is great when the poet, in presenting his tragic hero for public admiration, dares to say, "Weep for him, for he deserves it." For it is great to deserve the tears of those who deserve to shed tears. It is great that the poet dares to keep the crowd under control, dares to chastise people so that each examines himself as to whether he is worthy to weep for the hero, for the wastewater of blubberers is a debasement of the holy. Yet greater than all this is that the knight of faith dares to say even to the noble person who wants to weep for him, "Do not weep for me, but weep for yourself." One is moved. One returns to those beautiful times when sweet, tender longings lead one to the goal of one's desire, to see Christ walking about in the promised land. One forgets the anxiety, the distress, the paradox. Was it so easy a matter not to make a mistake? Was it not appalling that this person who walked among others was God? Was it not terrifying to sit down to eat with him? Was it so easy a matter to become an apostle? But the outcome, the 18 centuries, it helps. It lends a hand to that paltry deception whereby one deceives oneself and others. I do not feel brave enough to wish to be contemporary with such events, but for that reason I do not judge harshly of those who made a mistake, nor slightly of those who saw the right thing. But I return to Abraham. During the time before the outcome, Abraham was either at every moment a murderer, or we are at the paradox that is higher than all mediations. The story of Abraham contains, then, a teleological suspension of the ethical. As the single individual, he became higher than the universal. This is the paradox that cannot be mediated. How he entered into it is just as inexplicable as how he remains in it. If that is not the case with Abraham, then he is not even a tragic hero, but a murderer. To want to continue calling him the father of faith, to speak about it to people who do not concern themselves with anything but words, is thoughtless. A human being can become a tragic hero by his own strength, but not the knight of faith. When a person sets out on what, in a certain sense, is the hard way of the tragic hero, many will be able to advise him. The one who goes faith's narrow way, him no one can advise, no one can understand. Faith is a miracle, and yet no human being is excluded from it, for that which unites all human life is passion, and faith is a passion. Problem 2. Is there an absolute duty to God? The ethical is the universal, and as such, in turn, the divine. It is therefore right to say that every duty, after all, is duty to God. But if no more can be said, then one is saying as well that I really have no duty to God. Duty becomes duty by being referred to God, but in the duty itself I do not enter into relation to God. For instance, it is a duty to love one's neighbour. It is a duty by its being referred to God, but in the duty I do not enter into a relation to God, but to the neighbour I love. If I say then in this connection that it is my duty to love God, I'm really only stating a tautology, insofar as God here is understood in an entirely abstract sense as the divine, i.e. the universal, i.e. the duty. The whole existence of the human race rounds itself off in itself as a perfect sphere, and the ethical is at once its limit and its completion. God becomes an invisible vanishing point, an impotent thought, his power being only in the ethical, which completes existence. Insofar as it might occur to a person to want to love God in some sense other than the one indicated here, he is being quixotic. He loves a phantom, which, if it only had enough strength to speak, would say to him, "I do not ask for your love. Just stay where you belong." Insofar as it might occur to a person to want to love God differently, this love would be just as suspicious as the love which Rousseau mentions, whereby a person loves the Kaffirs instead of loving his neighbour. Now, if what has been advanced here is true, if there is nothing incommensurable in a human life, except the incommensurability that is there only by accident, from which nothing follows insofar as existence is considered ideally, then Hegel is right. But he is not right in speaking about faith or in allowing Abraham to be regarded as its father, for by the latter he has passed sentence both on Abraham and on faith. In Hegelian philosophy, the outer, the externalization, is higher than the inner. This is often illustrated by an example. The child is the inner, the man the outer. Hence, the child is determined precisely by the outer, and conversely, the man as the outer by the inner. Faith, on the contrary, is this paradox, that inwardness is higher than outwardness, or, to recall a previous expression, that the odd number is higher than the even. In the ethical view of life, then, the single individual's task is to divest himself of the qualification of inwardness and to express this in an outward form. Whenever the single individual shrinks from doing so, whenever he wants to stay within or slip down again into the inward qualification of feeling, mood, etc., he commits an offence and stands in temptation. The paradox of faith is this, that there is an inwardness that is incommensurable with the outer, an inwardness that, mind you, is not identical with that first one, but is a new inwardness. This must not be overlooked. Recent philosophy has presumed, without further ado, to substitute the immediate for faith. If one does that, then it is ludicrous to deny that faith has existed at all times. In that way, faith is put into rather vulgar company with feeling, mood, idiosyncrasy, hysteria, etc. To this extent, philosophy may be right in saying that one ought not to stop at that, but there is nothing that justifies philosophy in this usage. Faith is preceded by a movement of infinity. Only then does faith commence, unexpectedly, by virtue of the absurd. This I can well understand, without therefore professing to have faith. If faith is nothing beyond what philosophy passes it off to be, then Socrates has already gone further, much further, instead of the converse, that he did not arrive at it. Intellectually, he has made the movement of infinity. His ignorance is the infinite resignation. This task is already adequate for human strength, even though it is disdained in our age. But only when it is done, only when the single individual has exhausted himself in the infinite, only then is the point reached where faith can break forth. The paradox of faith, then, is this, that the single individual is higher than the universal, that the single individual, to recall a now rather rare theological distinction, determines his relation to the universal by his relation to the absolute, not his relation to the absolute by his relation to the universal. The paradox can also be expressed by saying that there is an absolute duty to God, for in this relationship of duty, the single individual relates himself as the single individual absolutely to the absolute. When in this connection it is said that it is a duty to love God, something different from the foregoing is meant by that. For if this duty is absolute, then the ethical is reduced to the relative. It does not follow from this that the ethical should be abolished, but it receives an entirely different expression, a paradoxical expression. In such a way, for example, that love for God can cause the knight of faith to give his love for the neighbour the opposite expression of what duty is, ethically speaking. If this is not so, then faith has no place in existence. Faith is thus a temptation, and Abraham is lost, since he yielded to it. This paradox cannot be mediated, for it is due precisely to the fact that the single individual is only the single individual. As soon as this single individual wants to express his absolute duty in the universal, becomes conscious of this in the latter, he perceives himself to be in a temptation, and then, if he otherwise resists it, does not come to fulfill the so-called absolute duty. And if he does not resist it, then he sins, even if his act in reality is equivalent to that which was his absolute duty. So what should Abraham have done? If he were to say to another person, "I love Isaac more than anything in the world, and that is why it is so hard for me to sacrifice him," the other person might very well have shaken his head and said, "Why sacrifice him then?" Or if the other had been an astute fellow, he would probably even have seen through Abraham and perceived that he wore his heart on his sleeve in glaring contradiction to his act. In the story of Abraham we find such a paradox. His relation to Isaac, ethically expressed, is this, that the father must love the son. This ethical relation is reduced to the relative in contradistinction to the absolute relation to God. To the question, why? Abraham has no other answer than that it is a trial, a test, which, as noted above, is the unity of its being for God's sake and for his own sake. These two qualifications also correspond to one another, as opposites, in ordinary usage. Thus, if one sees a person do something that does not conform to the universal, one says he hardly did it for God's sake, meaning thereby that he did it for his own sake. The paradox of faith has lost the intermediate factor, i.e. the universal. On the one hand, it is the expression for the highest egoism, doing the frightful deed for one's own sake. On the other hand, it is the expression for the most absolute devotion, doing it for God's sake. Faith itself cannot be mediated into the universal, for it is thereby annulled. Faith is this paradox, and the single individual is utterly unable to make himself intelligible to anyone. One may well imagine that the single individual can make himself intelligible to another single individual in the same situation. Such a view would be unthinkable if people in our age did not try in so many ways to sneak slyly into greatness. The one knight of faith cannot help the other at all. Either the single individual himself becomes the knight of faith by assuming the paradox, or he never becomes one. Partnership in these areas is utterly unthinkable. Any more detailed explanation of what is to be understood by Isaac can be given by the single individual always only to himself. And even if one could determine ever so precisely, generally speaking, what is to be understood by Isaac, which then, incidentally, would be the most ludicrous self-contradiction, to bring the single individual who stands precisely outside the universal under general categories when he should act precisely as the single individual who is outside the universal, The single individual would never be able to convince himself of this through others, only by himself as the single individual. Therefore, even if a person were cowardly and base enough to want to become a knight of faith on someone else's responsibility, he certainly would not become one. For only the single individual becomes that as the single individual, and this is the greatness of it, which I can certainly understand without entering therein, since I lack courage. But this is also the frightfulness of it, which I can understand even better. As is well known, in Luke chapter 14, verse 26, a remarkable teaching on the absolute duty to God is recited, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." This is a hard saying. Who can bear to listen to it? For that reason, it is also very seldom heard. Yet this silence is only an evasion that avails nothing. The theological student, however, learns that these words occur in the New Testament, and in one or another exegetical aid he finds the explanation that to hate in this and a couple of other passages by weakening it means love less, esteem less, honour not, value as nothing. The context in which these words occur, however, does not seem to corroborate this tasteful explanation. For a story is found in the following verse about how someone who wants to erect a tower first makes a rough estimate of whether he is equal to it, lest he be laughed at afterward. The close connection between this story and the cited verse seems precisely to indicate that the words should be taken as frightfully as possible in order that each person may examine himself as to whether he can erect the building. If that pious and accommodating exegete, who by haggling in this way thinks to smuggle Christianity into the world, had succeeded in convincing a person that grammatically, linguistically, and by analogy this was the meaning of that passage, then he will hopefully also succeed at the same time in convincing the same person that Christianity is one of the most pitiable things in the world. For the teaching, which in one of its most lyrical outpourings, where the consciousness of its eternal validity swells most strongly in it, has nothing to say but a noisy word that means nothing, but merely indicates that one should be less kind, less attentive, more indifferent. The teaching, which at the moment when it seems to want to say something frightful, ends by drivelling instead of striking with terror, that teaching certainly is not worth the trouble of standing up for. The words are frightful, yet I certainly believe one can understand them without implying that the person who has understood them therefore has the courage to do that. Thus, one ought to be honest enough to admit what they say and to acknowledge their greatness, even though one lacks the courage to do that oneself. Whoever behaves like that should not exclude himself from participation in the beautiful story, for in a way it does indeed contain comfort for the one who does not have courage to begin building the tower. But he must be honest and not explain this lack of courage as humility, when on the contrary it is pride, whereas the courage of faith is the only humble courage. Now it is easy to see that if the passage is to have any meaning, it must be understood literally. God is the one who demands absolute love. Now, whoever, on demanding a person's love, thinks in addition that this must be proved by his becoming lukewarm to everything that was otherwise dear to him, is not only an egoist, but foolish as well. And whoever would demand such a love simultaneously signs his own death warrant insofar as he has his life in this coveted love. For instance, a man requires his wife to leave father and mother, but if he were to regard it as a proof of her extraordinary love for him that for his sake she became a lukewarm, indifferent daughter, etc., then he is more foolish than the greatest fool. If he had any idea what love is, he would then wish to discover that as a daughter and sister she was perfect in love, and see in that an assurance that his wife would love him as she does nobody else in the kingdom. Thus what would be regarded as a sign of egoism and foolishness in a person may be regarded by the help of an exegete as a worthy representation of divinity. But how then hate them? I shall not recall here the human distinction between loving and hating, not because I have so much against it, for it is, after all, passionate, but because it is egoistic and inappropriate here. However, if I regard the task as a paradox, then I understand it, i.e., I understand it in the way one can understand a paradox. The absolute duty may then bring one to do what ethics would forbid, but it can never make the knight of faith stop loving. Abraham demonstrates this. The moment he is willing to sacrifice Isaac, the ethical expression for what he does is this: he hates Isaac. But if he really hates Isaac, he can be sure that God does not ask it of him, for Cain and Abraham are not identical. He must love Isaac with all his heart. Inasmuch as God demands Isaac, Abraham must love him, if possible, even more dearly, and only then can he sacrifice him. For it is indeed this love for Isaac which, by its paradoxical opposition to his love for God, makes his act a sacrifice. But the distress and anxiety in the paradox is that, humanly speaking, he is utterly unable to make himself intelligible. Only at the moment when his act is in absolute contradiction to his feeling, only then does he sacrifice Isaac. But the reality of his act is that by which he belongs to the universal, and there he is and remains a murderer. Furthermore, the passage in Luke must be understood in such a way that one perceives that the knight of faith has no higher expression of the universal, as the ethical, at all in which he can save himself. If we thus let the church require this sacrifice from one of its members, then we have only a tragic hero. For the idea of the church is not qualitatively different from that of the state, inasmuch as the single individual can enter into it by a simple mediation. Upon entering into the paradox, the single individual does not arrive at the idea of the church. He does not leave the paradox, but must find either his eternal blessedness or his perdition within it. An ecclesiastical hero expresses the universal in his deed, and no one in the church, not even his father and mother, etc., will fail to understand him. But he is not the knight of faith, and also has a different response from Abraham's. He does not say that it is a trial or a test in which he is being tried. People generally refrain from citing such passages as that one in Luke. They are apprehensive of letting people loose, for fear that the worst will happen once the single individual deigns to behave as the single individual. Moreover, they think that existing as the single individual is the easiest thing of all, and therefore one must just coerce people into becoming the universal. I can share neither that fear nor that opinion, and for the same reason. Whoever has learned that existing as the single individual is the most terrifying thing of all will not be afraid of saying that it is the greatest. But he must also say it in such a way that his words scarcely become a trap for someone gone astray, but rather help that person into the universal, even if his words make a little room for greatness. Whoever dares not mention such passages dares not mention Abraham either, and the notion that existing as the single individual is easy enough contains a very dubious indirect admission with respect to oneself. For anyone who actually has self-esteem and concern for his soul is convinced that whoever lives solely under his own supervision in the world at large lives more strictly and secluded than a maiden in her boudoir. It is no doubt true that there may be those who need coercion, those who, if set at liberty, would, like a wild animal, give free rein to selfish desire, But one must demonstrate that one does not belong to them precisely by the fact that one knows how to speak with fear and trembling. And one must speak out of respect for the great, lest it be forgotten for fear of the harm that surely will not come if spoken in such a way that one knows it is the great and knows its terrors, without which one does not know its greatness either. Let us then consider in a little more detail the distress and anxiety in the paradox of faith. The tragic hero resigns himself in order to express the universal. The knight of faith resigns the universal in order to become the single individual. As I said, everything depends on how one is situated. Anyone who believes that it is easy enough to be the single individual can always rest assured that he is not the knight of faith, for vagabonds and vagrant geniuses are not men of faith. On the contrary, this knight knows that it is glorious to belong to the universal. He knows that it is beautiful and beneficial to be the particular individual who translates himself into the universal, one who, so to speak, personally produces a clean-cut, elegant, and insofar as possible, flawless edition of himself, readable by all. He knows it is refreshing to become intelligible to oneself in the universal in such a way that he understands the latter, and every individual who understands him in turn understands the universal through him, and both rejoice in the security of the universal. He knows it is beautiful to be born as the particular individual who has his home in the universal, his friendly abode, which immediately receives him with open arms when he wants to remain in it. But he knows as well that higher than this, there winds a lonely trail, narrow and steep. He knows that it is frightful to be born solitary, outside the universal, to walk without meeting a single traveller. He knows very well where he is and how he relates to people. Humanly speaking, he is mad and cannot make himself intelligible to anyone. And yet, it is the mildest expression to say that he is mad. If he is not viewed in this way, then he is a hypocrite. And indeed, the higher he climbs on the trail, the more appalling a hypocrite he is. The knight of faith knows that it is inspiring to surrender oneself to the universal, that it takes courage for this, but that there is also a security in it precisely because it is for the universal. He knows that it is glorious to be understood by every noble-minded person, and in such a way that the observer himself is ennobled thereby. This he knows, and he feels as though bound. He could wish that it was this task that was assigned to him. In like manner, Abraham might now and then have wished that the task was to love Isaac as a father would and should, intelligible to all, unforgettable for all time. He could wish that the task was to sacrifice Isaac for the universal, so that he could inspire fathers to illustrious deeds, and he is almost horrified by the thought that for him such wishes only constitute temptations and must be treated as such. For he knows it is a lonely trail he treads, and that he accomplishes nothing for the universal, but is himself only being tried and tested. Or what did Abraham accomplish for the universal? Let me speak humanly about it, purely humanly. He takes 70 years to get a son of his old age. What others get quickly enough and enjoy for a long time takes him 70 years to get. And why? Because he is being tried and tested. Is that not madness? But Abraham believed. Only Sarah vacillated and got him to take Hagar as a concubine, but that is why he also had to drive her away. He receives Isaac. Then he must be tried once more. He knew that it is glorious to express the universal, glorious to live with Isaac. But that is not the task. He knew it is kingly to sacrifice such a son for the universal. He personally would have found rest in it, and everyone would have rested approvingly in his deed, just as the vowel rests in its silent consonant. But that is not the task. He is being tried. That Roman general, renowned by his nickname Cunctator, stopped the enemy by his procrastination. Yet what a procrastinator Abraham is in comparison with him. But he does not save the state. This is the content of 130 years. Who can endure it? Would not his contemporaries, if there could be talk of such, say, there is an eternal procrastination with Abraham? Finally he got a son. That took long enough. Then he wants to sacrifice him. Is he not mad? And he could at least explain why he wants to do it, but it is always a trial. Nor could Abraham explain further, for his life is like a book that is placed under divine injunction and is not in the public domain. This is the frightful aspect. Whoever does not see this can always be sure that he is no knight of faith, but whoever does see it will not deny that even the most tried tragic hero, as it were, dances along in comparison with the slow and creeping progress of the knight of faith. Having perceived this, and assured himself that he does not have the courage to understand it, he then may well sense the wondrous glory that knight attains in becoming God's confidant, the Lord's friend, and, to speak very humanly, in saying you to God in heaven, whereas even the tragic hero only addresses him in the third person. The tragic hero is soon finished and at peace. He makes the infinite movement and is now secure in the universal. The knight of faith, on the contrary, is kept sleepless, for he is constantly being tried. At every moment there is a possibility of being able to return repentantly to the universal, and this possibility can just as well be a temptation as truth. Enlightenment on that score cannot be gotten from any human being, for then he is outside the paradox. First and foremost, then, the knight of faith has the passion to concentrate in a single moment the whole of the ethical he violates in order to give himself the assurance that he actually loves Isaac with his whole heart. If he cannot do that, then he stands in temptation. Next, he has the passion to produce the whole of this assurance in the twinkling of an eye, and in such a way that it is just as valid as in the first instance. If he cannot do that, then he does not get going, for he must constantly begin afresh. The tragic hero also concentrates in one moment the ethical he has transcended teleologically, but in this respect he has a place of resort in the universal. The knight of faith has simply and solely himself, and therein lies the frightfulness. Most people live in an ethical obligation in such a way that they let each day have its cares, but then they never obtain this passionate concentration, this intensive consciousness. In a certain sense, the universal can assist the tragic hero in attaining this, but the knight of faith is alone in everything. The tragic hero acts and finds rest in the universal. The knight of faith is kept in constant tension. Agamemnon gives up Iphigenia, and having thereby found rest in the universal, now proceeds to sacrifice her. If Agamemnon has not made the movement, if at the decisive moment his soul, instead of being passionately concentrated, has been absorbed in common blather about his having several daughters, and that perhaps the extraordinary still could happen, then naturally he is not a hero, but a charity case. Abraham also has the concentration of the hero, even though in him it is far more difficult, since he has no place of resort at all in the universal, but he makes one more movement by which he concentrates his soul back upon the miracle. If Abraham has not done that, then he is only an Agamemnon, provided it can otherwise be explained how being willing to sacrifice Isaac can be justified when one does not benefit the universal by it. Whether the single individual is now actually situated in a state of temptation or is a knight of faith, only the individual himself can determine. Nevertheless, it is surely possible to construct out of the paradox some distinguishing characteristic that one not in it can also understand. The true knight of faith is always in absolute isolation. The counterfeit knight is sectarian. The latter is an attack.